Bud, let's jump ahead for the war to your test pilot years. You spent so many years flying every conceivable airplane. What was the riskiest or dumbest or whatever test program that you can recall, if there was any such thing?
Oh. Well, the riskiest thing I did was probably the wingtip coupling. It takes me an hour to describe all that.
Well, what was the idea?
Idea was the range extension. And they wanted to, on the tip of a wing, put a floating panel that was just hinged there on the tip of the wing. And they wanted to prove that. It was like something for nothing. You could take a big airplane, put that on it. Don't worry about how you take off and land and all this kind of stuff. This is theory. And so it was a German scientist, by the way, that was coming up with this idea. I think he was trying to get even with us. And so he said, let's hook up airplanes in flight and get the data, and that'll prove the theory. Well, that's okay, but we'd never hooked airplanes up in flight before. So we took a Gutenberg, a C-47, and a little teeny Culver Cadet to go out and make those actual hookups. And I did the first flights on all of that. And the very first one was kind of exciting. They wanted me to control the airplane out here with the use of the ailerons. Because in the design philosophy of the follow-on project, it was a geared thing, you know, when it drooped into so many degrees, it would apply so much aileron in there to bring the airplane up. Well, we went to a very high altitude for the Culver. And you know how light planes, you got the throttle up there and there's nothing there, you know, no reserve power. And we're flying as slow as the Goonie Bird could go, and probably as fast as I could go. But it was you didn't have the reserve power to maneuver in and out. And then it had a ring, a beveled ring, and I had a little ball with a probe on the back of it, and I had to get in front of it and back into it. Kind of an unnatural process. And I tried for about 30 minutes to hook up, and the vortex around the wing of the C-47 is a big vortex, and you come in there and it pushes you up and out, up and out. I had done it before, and you know, just flying the airplane down low, I could get it in there pretty close and almost touch the wingtip and hold it there. But now we're up, 10,000 feet or higher for safety. And it was difficult. And this is one of my first projects, and I wasn't about to fail. So I got it in there as close as I could and just cut the power back. And careful what you wish for sometimes. And bang, the thing hooked in and drooped down 90 degrees. There I am holding full aileron, kind of looking up like this. I said, that didn't feel too good. Gave it full power, flew out. And we went, got on the ground and talked it over. We had to clean out the cockpit too. And we said, you know, we need to do this down lower so we can have some power to get it in and engage it, and then still have and let me figure out how to control the airplane, because the ailerons don't work. And it was like a swivel joint. And so he gave it a little bit of pitch. That gave it lift, and that brought it right up to the proper position. Once we learned how to do it, I could go up there and hook on in 10 seconds. And the Goonie Bird could do anything he wanted to do. And then we had a follow-on program with a B-29 and two F-84s. And that was a lot different because we got a B-29 that doesn't fly fast. And he's going along as fast as he can. And we're coming in with the F-84s at a very low speed trying to hook in forward this time. And the fuel controls weren't the best in those days, and it was a lot more difficult. And then the wing on the B-29 was a very flexible wing, as opposed to the Goonie Bird, which is was like a a rail. And we got the data, and it proved the theory in a sense. It said flying on a favorable profile, the best profile for the configuration of the aircraft, versus a B-29's mission, we only lost 2.9% of the range. But if you put fuel in that pedal, obviously it would be an advantage. But it ended in a fatal crash after I left the program and kind of threw a wet blanket on the whole thing.
Let me take you backwards, back to the Mustangs and out of England, 357th. How did you keep that many airplanes healthy and in the air day after day after day? What's it say about the maintenance guys?
Well, let me tell you my crew chief story.
Great.
Now, the pilots were all aged from 19, or maybe even, I don't know whether we had any 18 years old, but later on they did bring in 18 years old, but ours were, we maybe had 19 or 20 would be our youngest. And I think the oldest, the old man, was probably 27. And but we didn't have many of those. And I think my age, 20, I flew all my combat at age 22, was probably a good medium age for a combat pilot in our wing. And the crew chiefs, some of them were young, most of them were a little bit older, you know. And can you imagine yourself being a crew chief responsible for one of these airplanes and it went down for any reason whatsoever? Think how you would feel, especially if it was a mechanical problem. So they were very dedicated. They wanted to do their part. They were just as patriotic as the pilots were. We were a bunch of eager young pilots, and these guys were there to help us. And the story I like to tell is about my crew chief, Otto Heino. And I, being a flight leader, when we were in Tonopah, Nevada, we could pick our, it ended up where I picked out my own crew chief and kept him all through the war. And I really liked him. He was so confident he wouldn't even take an assistant crew chief. Usually he had a three-man thing. And I got an armor also that stayed with me. So we were flying these old beat-up P-39s. And, you know, we had a gun sight right on the armor plate, and it's just a quarter of an inch off the armor plate was a combining glass where the reticle is displayed electronically on there. And these old airplanes, they were old and they got all dusty in there. You couldn't clean it. The only way I figure you could clean it was to take the sight out, and then you'd have to recalibrate it and all that stuff. So he comes to me and he says, "How can I help you with this airplane? How can I make it better?" And I said, "God, can you clean that damn gun sight?" And he kind of nodded at me. And then the morning I come out and I'm flying around, this thing is crystal clear. And I said, "How'd you do that?" And he handed up a turkey feather. He'd found a damn feather and he'd gone in there and cleaned that out. He was very ingenious. And he was like that. He was a perfectionist. So we get over in England, and he's my crew chief for my whole first tour. Then I went home and came back. Well, he got promoted to tech sergeant, and he was a line chief now, and he had six airplanes to look over. But he was always at mine to see it off, and he was always there when I came back. And in the fall of 1944, you see all these airplanes. We got silver, we got all camo. Well, we had half camo and half silver. We weren't paying too much attention to the paint schemes. As a matter of fact, a lot of the World War II pictures you see are good for that moment. And we go out in the fall of 44, and the first big snow had hit Germany. And I knew, by the way, on my second tour, I'm going to finish somewhere around the first of the year, and it'll be winter the whole time. And I looked down, I saw these four airplanes flying. Two of them were camouflaged, dark, and two of them were silver. Well, which one stuck out? You know, the dark one, of course. And the silver ones were kind of camouflaged. And so when I get back from this mission, the three guys are waiting there, and I said, the airplane's okay, get it ready to go. And I said, oh, by the way, the next time this thing is laid up for heavy maintenance, you know, down for a couple of days, I would like you to depaint it into a silver paint scheme, all silver. And I put it to him on the basis that it might save my butt, you know, tactically, you know. But privately, I thought this was a cooler paint scheme. So I walked out over the revetment and went to operation. I'm going to fly tomorrow. But when I was the operations officer then, I think I'll fly tomorrow. And I go home, and in the morning, breakfast briefing, come out, get my parachute, walk up over the revetment, and I'm standing there looking down, and it's like this, silver. And these three guys are standing there kind of at attention. They're standing there at attention, and I looked at their hands, and they'd been scrubbing that paint off with anything they could find. They were using 145-grade fuel. That's what we had used. And you can imagine what that did to their hands. They were so blistered and a little bloody, and I felt like a jerk. Jesus, did these guys think I gave them a direct order to do that? They started work on that the minute I left and worked straight through the night and had it ready to go. Then I thought about it a little bit, and I said, no, you know, these guys wanted to do that. That was their part. That's their contribution to the war. And I can't say enough about the crew chiefs of the world.